Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We'll just get ourselves started now. Thank you very much for coming along to this IHR Modern French History Seminar. Tonight's speaker is Alison Carroll from Brunel University in London. And she's going to be talking to us about her specialist topic, which is Alsace, with a paper entitled The Return of Alsace to France in 1918. And so, without further ado, I'll pass straight over to Alison.
Thank you. Yes, so I called the paper The Return of Alsace to France, but I'd like to focus on one particular aspect of that in the paper today, which is, I suppose, the border and how the border shapes the return of Alsace to France. But I called it The Return of Alsace to France just because I didn't know exactly what I was going to be speaking about when I gave you the paper title. But I think also it's useful to give you a quick overview of what the topic is. So it's a big project where I'm tracing what it means for Alsace to become French again after almost 50 years of annexation into Germany in 1918. And so I've been thinking about the region's economy, its political structures, society, culture, laws, administration, the landscape. And I'm interested, firstly, in how the French state tried to make the region French, and secondly, in how Alsatians interpreted return to France, what they thought it meant, and how they adopted, resisted, and appropriated French policies of reintegration between 1918 and 1939. So a big theme that's emerged from this is the clash between, on the one hand, the notion on the part of French administrators that paths to Frenchness are wholly progressive and beneficial, and on the other, the response to this idea in Alsace, where many Alsatians found the resulting operating assumptions quite uncomfortable. And this is something that's played out in all kinds of issues. So debates over language to the consumption of wine have this clash between these two understandings of what it means to be French. But I wanted to talk about the border because I think it plays out particularly clearly at the border. So that's why I decided to talk about this today, to think about the return of Alsace from the perspective of the border, considering how looking at it from this location brings ideas about nationhood into relief, but also thinking about the border itself as a driver of change and a motive force that shapes identities and shapes experiences in the region after 1918. The paper speaks to the historiography about peasants into Frenchmen and this debate that's been going on for some time, but also speaks to a growing historiography about the role of borders in modern Europe. And I think work's inspired by the transnational turn, by events since 1989, and the movement towards considering processes of transfer and thinking beyond the nation has encouraged scholars to look at borders and borderlands and to treat them as, on the one hand, the limits of the nation state, and on the other, a point of contact between neighbouring populations, where local populations forge their own understandings of language and culture and citizenship through cross-border contact. And this field of scholarship has had two major implications for how we think about the ways in which nations are formed. So first of all, it has stressed that policies are not simply crafted at the centre and then disseminated to the periphery, but actually they take shape in important ways at the periphery itself. And secondly, it's underlined that there were multiple connections that spanned across national boundaries, and these can take a variety of forms. So it could be cross-border transnational networks or associations. It could also be family ties, the diffusion of ideas, or short-term trips for walk, or for work, or for shopping, or permanent migration. And so these connections transcend borders, but they also help to make them, because these movements across the borders have stimulated anxieties that triggered new efforts to monitor and to police and to control. So in this way, cross-border connections have contributed to the construction of nations, and they offer a reminder that nations aren't formed in isolation, that they're formed in part through contact. And in this field of histories of borders and borderlands, there's a consensus that's emerging that borders are sites of contact more than they represent limits between nations. And this has been the conclusion coming out of a number of recent works. I think this is something that I do accept, but I also think that it opens up a set of further questions, and crucially, the types of the different types of contact that happens in border regions. And that's what I'm going to focus on today and think about crossings. So contact that takes the place of border crossings. So how understandings of crossings shaped ideas about the border. And this is one of my favourite images on the screen from Alsace. So this is the Germans crossing the border and returning to the country of their birth in 1918. And the Germans are recognisable in their hats and their shoes and the fact that they're either very, very fat or very thin. Most of them are wearing glasses. Like, I'm really interested in this very orderly way that this crossing of the border is depicted in that image. So that's the backdrop to what I'm talking about. But when I'm talking about border crossings, I suppose I'm not talking so much about the mechanics of how people crossed, but rather on how the crossings were interpreted by the agents of the French state. So the crossing guards who are manning the checkpoints, the police officers who are reporting on any unusual activity, of course what they perceive to be unusual activity, and the administrators who describe the impact of crossings on the local population. And the sources produced by these agents of the state are the sources that I'm basing this on. So I spent a lot of time reading about the problems of policing night trains, like whether you wake people up and how they complain about that, or what exactly it is that people are trying to smuggle. And I was surprised by the fact that arms are passing through Alsace to go to Melbourne. But through, I think, so these sources, kind of reading them, they've given me an insight into the micro-historical level of the locality. So the fabric of everyday life, how people adapted to the new border, which moved when Alsace returned from Germany to France. But also there's always implications that kind of connect with the broader perspectives of the nation, of ideas about national security, national cohesion, international relationships, and transnational flows and movements of people and goods and ideas. So the two things that I'd like you to think about in terms of the border as you listen to my examples from these sources. The first one is that, of course, it was a literal boundary line. So there were thousands of border posts. I've read about the process of unpacking them and how many were damaged and the problems this caused. But also that it was a symbol. So it's a symbol of the limits of the nation. But for many people, particularly those living in the borderlands, it was also a symbol of possible connection and potential connection that crossed, that spanned across the border. And then the other thing is that, I suppose, there's what Daphne Badal has talked about as the paradox of the border. So on the one hand, it's a site of intense clarity. So Peter Sahlins talked about the Pyrenees as a privileged site for the articulation of national distinctions. So it's at the border with, where you have the presentation of passports and identity papers, and coming into contact with agents of the state. Doing all of this crystallises nationality. But at the same time, it's also a transitional zone, or people have talked about borderlands as liminal spaces where identity could be particularly fluid. A blurring of different national communities. And what this means is that the borderland was both a place of intense clarity and of complicated ambiguity. And the resulting tension shaped how border crossings were interpreted after 1918. So they're the things that I'd like you to kind of have in mind as you think about borders, as I talk now about border crossings. So starting with the 1920s, then moving on to the 1930s, to think about change over time. Zahra Steiner talked about this period, the 1920s as post-war and the 1930s as pre-war, and the differences and how we should think about them. So that's kind of something else that I'd like you to think about as I'm talking about this. But before I talk about crossings, I'd just like to briefly give you some context and also to talk about how the border was actually drawn after 1918. So this is a moment when Alsace-Lorraine returned to French rule. And even though my bigger project is about the return of Alsace to France, I'll be talking about Lorraine in this paper as well, and about making the entire, remaking the entire eastern frontier after 1918. So the provinces had been annexed into the German Empire in 1871, and following Prussia's victory in the Franco-Prussian War. During the 50 years of annexation, a myth of the lost provinces had emerged, and this was kept alive by Alsatian and Lorrainer émigrés in Paris, who depicted the region's population as patiently waiting for their liberation by France. Of course, things in Alsace-Lorraine were not quite so simple, and there's been a lot of really excellent work on the period of annexation that shows just the gradual process of integration of the provinces into the German Empire. And of course, this built on long-standing ties that connected the left and right banks of the Rhine and linked the region to the German lands. And the result of this was that when France recovered the so-called lost provinces in 1918, Alsatians and Lorrainers were tied to their German neighbours by language, by culture, and by kin. And for the past half century, they had been members of the same nation state. So to deal with this, French policy focused on sealing the region against German influence. They classified the population according to ethnicity. Many German-born inhabitants were forced to leave for the Weimar Republic, and this is what this image is showing you. The French language was introduced in schools and courts and in administrative institutions. The French franc replaced the German mark. German companies and investments in the railways and the potash mines were sequestered and transferred to French ownership. The hyphenated Alsace-Lorraine was broken up and replaced with three departments, so the Upper and Lower Rhine in Alsace and the Moselle in annexed Lorraine. And French laws were introduced. I mean, originally France talked about introducing them all wholesale, but it was suggested that this might prove difficult. So they're introduced in a piecemeal fashion. And in particular, the planned introduction of the separation of church and state provoked a lot of opposition in the region, and so much resistance that successive governments ended up leaving it intact. So reintegration was a lengthy process, which is why in the project I'm thinking about return as over the period of 20 years. It's not something that happens in this moment in 1918. It's something that lasts much longer. And government attempts to introduce the French language, culture and history into the region were adopted and appropriated and resisted by regional populations that had their own quite clear ideas about the return to France. And these problems of reintegration set the backdrop and also have they helped to shape the policing of border crossings after 1918. So as well as all of these policies to make the region French, France also needed to redraw the border with Germany. The Treaty of Versailles had restored the boundary line that existed on the 18th of July 1870, which you see up there. But it left open the possibility of modifying this line if necessary. And so as diplomats and members of the army looked at this, it soon became clear that modifications would be necessary because of changes since 1871. So new railway lines had been constructed, villages had been expanded, sections of the Rhine had been rerouted. So France and Germany agreed to the creation of a border delimitation committee. I think this is an important point because it means that the new border was a process of negotiation between France and Germany. And people often talk about borders being drawn by diplomats and then made meaningful at the grassroots, but actually the whole process of drawing it was something that involved negotiation. And as well as it being between France and Germany, the local population also contributed to the drawing of the border. The delimitation committee sent copies of the 19th century treaties that had fixed the border to each town hall in the recovered departments, and they asked for comments about whether it would be possible to reinstate the old boundary line and also if there'd been any change of use in the land that would mean the border would need to be moved. So in one case, which was that of Valdevissa in the Moselle, there was a problem because the border cut across a railway tunnel. And the tunnel itself was on French territory, but both of the entrances were in the Saar, which was the German territory that's placed under League of Nations control in 1919, with a plebiscite to be held on its future in 1935. And the director of the Alsace-Lorraine Railways worried that the tunnel entrances could be a problem if the Saar voted to return to Germany in 1935, as, of course, it did. Now, the committee proposed giving France one of the tunnel entrances to get rid of this problem, but the commune of Valdevissa protested that this would cut off their access to their communal land. So in response to their protest, the committee decided to modify the border instead. And I think that's quite interesting because the committees weren't just consulting the populations, they did actually listen to them as well. And this speaks to a general principle that is evident throughout the discussions, which is that good borders make for good neighbours when we're thinking about this border between France and Germany. So as well as this broad principle, the committee discussions reveal intersecting concerns. Security, economics, practicality and prestige all guided the French position in these discussions. And this was the case as they debated cases where stations were cut in two or houses cut off from the rest of the village. But the Commission also showed changing ideas about borders between the 19th century and the 20th as they dealt with the question of property held by Alsatian communities on the German side of the Rhine and by Baden communes on the French side. So, and this was actually quite a common situation. In some cases, it had been caused by works on the river in the 1870s when it had been rerouted, so the land that had been on one side was now on the other. But in others, it was because 19th century borders had allowed communes to own property on the other side of the boundary line. And the Treaty of Versailles transferred all of the German property to the French state, but it left open the question of what to do with French property on the German side. Both Germany and France agreed that allowing French communes to keep property on the German side would get in the way of good neighbourly relations. That's the phrase that's used. So the Weimar government offered compensation to Alsatian communes that were affected. In most cases, the Alsatian communes rejected this compensation and they said it wasn't adequate. And some of these cases went unresolved throughout the interwar years. So this point kind of mediates the last one. Local populations' ideas being listened to and taken seriously, but at the same time, these need to fit in with bigger ideas about security and what makes a good border for them to be fully listened to. And so one thing that is evident in these discussions is a change in ideas about what a border should be. So the idea that good borders make for good nations is a constant, but there is a shift from the 19th century idea that it's possible for communes to own territory on a neighbouring national territory. By these discussions after 1918, it was widely accepted that a good border was a neat one, so one single neat border. And the treaty delimiting the Franco-German border was eventually signed on the 14th of August 1924. And the time taken between the formation of the committees in 1919 and the eventual signature in 1924 reflects just how much negotiation and discussion was required. But even before the border was fixed, people were already crossing it. And of course, in many cases, crossings were actually inspired by the existence of the border, as people crossed to buy cheaper goods on the other side, or goods such as tobacco and drugs were smuggled across. So some crossings were inspired by the border in this period. And those crossings that took place in the very first months and weeks after the armistice were particularly difficult. Just there was so much confusion and chaos at the end of the war. And in this period, I've actually read accounts of local administrators and even members of the Border Delimitation Committee being refused access to cross the border. And these kind of very colourful accounts of, we were in our car, which is marked with all of our who we are, we were wearing uniforms, we had our papers saying we're members of the Delimitation Committee, but because it didn't specifically say we're allowed to cross the border, the crossing guards wouldn't let us go across. Now, this was very worrying to the French Foreign Ministry, as they were quite concerned that it would provoke a major incident, and they were focused on the border as a place where this might happen. And I think the fact that they were stopped, I think it is just a reflection of how confused things were at that moment in the aftermath of the war. But of course, and the border guards were especially vigilant about an incident going on there. And I think this speaks to a notion that you see coming through in these reports about the border being both the strong point and the weak point of the nation. So it's connected to the idea that it's the limits and a site of contact, in that it's a site of fortifications and of where the agents of the state are very present, but at the same time, there's the possibility for chinks in the chain. So that kind of comes through in these reports. When I talk about the confusion and chaos, it's coming back to this image, which perhaps doesn't really tally with a lot of the reports from people who did actually leave. They talk about people being packed into cattle wagons and forced to leave Alsace and the Moselle and head back to Germany. So in total, it was around 150,000 Germans, or individuals who were labelled as Germans, who were forced to leave Alsace and the Moselle, which represented around 15% of the regional population in 1918. So that was the context to the early crossings. But once that was out of the way, throughout the 1920s, France was much more focused on, because it was focused on the problems of reintegrating Alsace and the Moselle, its focus in terms of border crossings was on locals who were making short-term trips, so residents of borderland communities. And I think when I was reading the correspondence, I was struck by just how much attention the French devoted to making crossing easier. That wasn't what I expected to find. So one agreement in May 1922 allowed borderland inhabitants who had communal land on the other side to cross without a visa. In October that year, the town of Strasbourg and Kehl on the German side introduced a similar scheme for inhabitants of the two towns to cross and to go shopping on the other side of the border. And this was actually pushed for by Strasbourg's Chamber of Commerce, which saw it as an opportunity to boost the local economy. In 1925, the prefect of the Upper Rhine decided to allow entry without a visa to any German citizen who needed to enter the department in an emergency. So he specifically said the death of a parent, but any emergency that arose from the connections between the two communities. They just had to pay 10 francs and leave as soon as the emergency was over. Now, each of these arrangements was restricted to inhabitants of border communes, and so this is suggestive of the fact that administrators recognised that there were different categories of crossers, but also that border crossing was a necessary and kind of sometimes desirable part of daily life for locals. So a lot of time was spent making crossings easier, but the French also devoted considerable attention to policing them. And one of the major questions that guided the policing of crossings in the 1920s was that of the perceived, and the quote is, national ambiguity of the Alsatians and Mosellans. So essentially they were not the Frenchmen that France had expected to find in the region in 1918. The majority of the population spoke a German language. Culturally, the French saw more connections to Germany. There were ties through through society, through family, and also attachment to local traditions. And administrators, the French administrators who arrived, conflated language and cultural ties with attachment to Germany and loyalty to Germany, and worried that the opposition to particular elements of French policy reflected opposition to France. And they also worried that holding identity papers wasn't an accurate representation of feelings. And so this is something that comes through, is they're trying to police those individuals who were born in Germany or to German parents who had naturalised and stayed in Alsace and the Moselle, whether because they'd married Alsatians and Mosellans or because they're in protected industries. And the concern was that they could masquerade as French. And then on the other side, that there were mixed Alsatian, Mosellan, German couples who'd gone to Germany who could potentially come back in and wouldn't be able to be policed in quite the right way. So the special commissioner at the checkpoint between Kiel and Strasbourg was very, very worried about this for most of the first 5 years of French rule. And he talked in particular about people who had two sets of identity papers, that when they were crossing the border into France, they would present French passports that he believed they would have obtained on presenting papers stating their place of birth or that of their wives. But when the crossing guards searched their bags, they found German travel passes, which gave them the nationality of one of the states of the Weimar Republic. And this, the fact that they had both French and German identity papers kind of gave a concrete form to this national ambiguity that administrators were talking about in all of these other less tangible ways, language and culture. And the special commissioner at Kiel judged this to be particularly dangerous, but he said that there was actually no doubt about their genuine sentiments, as he thought that these were the people who came to Alsace-Lorraine and then went home and wrote up their experiences when they got back to what he called their true nation. And that they were just there to write about the fact that Alsace-Lorraine were rightfully German and to create problems in the region. And his concerns are reflective of the fact that Germans represented a particular problem in the ideas of many administrators, because Germany was perceived to be France's central threat. And so there was a lot of concern about the Germans who were crossing from Baden to Alsace and the Moselle. In January 1924, the General Commissioner described every German crosser as an agent of the Reich, capable of conducting pro-German and anti-French propaganda. And they're very attuned to what this propaganda might be. And there's lots of reports of Germans being blamed for spreading rumours. So the month in January 1924, when Alain Petit described them in that way, police reports blamed German tradesmen for the circulation of pessimistic rumours about the future of the franc. And apparently, because Germans were coming in and being pessimistic, Alsatians were withdrawing their savings from the bank and refusing to invest in treasury bonds. So they're very concerned about the impact of these Germans on the borderland. And this, I think this example suggests that the problems presented by German crosses were primarily national, but they're also economic. And this was one of the ties that administrators perhaps hadn't been as prepared for. So in the early years, particular attention came to focus on those who came to shop in Alsace and the Moselle. And this was quite a regular thing up until January 1923, when French troops launched their occupation of the Ruhr Valley after Germany's failure to meet its reparations payments. Weimar responded with passive resistance and the boycotting of French products, and the Borderlanders responded by putting a stop to their shopping trips to Alsatian and Moselland towns. This led to a decline in trade and produced a measurable dip in the regional economy, which actually forced administrators to recognise the positive impact of these border crossings. And so when the passive resistance ended, customs officials wrote about the fact that they were now turning a blind eye to the goods that borderland shoppers bought in Alsace and the Moselle. But then the situation shifted the following year. So this was the moment of the collapse in the value of the German mark, which led to a dramatic rise in prices in the Weimar Republic. And this triggered a massive increase in the number of border crossings into France for people who were going shopping. And the things that they were buying were essentials rather than luxuries. You know, bread, sugar, coffee, meat and vegetables were the main things that they were buying. And the presence of these Germans coming shopping pushed local prices up. In January 1924, the prefect of the Upper Rhine estimated that Germans had spent 80,000 francs in Mulhouse in 1 week alone, which led to a tripling in the normal rate of purchasing. And as similar reports came in from across the region, this prompted prefects of both the Alsatian departments to call on the government to restrict movement between Alsace and the neighbouring German territories. And they did so. So the General Commission ordered the limiting of border crossings by German citizens from the borderland, stepping up the surveillance of those who did enter, and then, when necessary, turning away travellers even when they had a pass. So I think these kind of cases of shopping are suggestive of the tension between public concern over price increases and the cost of living on the one hand, and then local shopkeepers' growing reliance on cross-border trade on the other. And this really came through in April 1924, when the shopkeepers of Wissembourg in the northeast of Alsace submitted a petition demanding that border restrictions be eased to allow shoppers to come in to their town. They said this had been done the previous Christmas and it had provided a very welcome boost to the local economy. And this was important because Alsace was struggling with the problems of reintegrating to French systems and French economic systems. And so the local economy was faltering a little as it tried to make the movement to French markets. But the police commissioner, when he looked at this petition, advised against it on the basis of popular opinion. So he said that when the shoppers had come the previous Christmas, they had caused a massive increase in prices. And the general feeling in the town was that the shopkeepers had allowed their greed to overtake their patriotism by putting these German shoppers over their regular customers. So I think it's interesting because of how economic implications are read in terms of national implications, and the two become almost inseparable in these reports. So just to summarise the situation in the 1920s, I think the problems that France encountered in reintegrating Alsace and the Moselle meant that questions of national unity and the place of Alsatians and Moselle within the French national community were at the forefront of the concerns of the crossing guards as they policed and monitored border crossings. In 1918, France hadn't been fully prepared for the realities of life in Alsace and the Moselle, and particularly for the region's cross-border social and cultural and linguistic ties. And in this environment, crossing guards and administrators read these ties through the prism of loyalty to France. Rather than thinking about them in the terms that the Alsatians and Mosellans tried to describe them, which was in terms of regional particularities. And with such questions of national integration at the forefront of their minds, the focus at the border fell on how to make sense of these local crossers, the borderlanders who needed to cross to visit family or to access communal land, or who crossed to work or to shop. And it was all of these interpretations are very much focused on the locality. Then this changed in the 1930s, I suppose largely in reflection of the changed situation in Europe. So in the 1930s, crossings continued, and many people did cross for the same reasons that had motivated crossings in the 1920s. So they still visited family, they still went shopping, and they took holidays and they accessed their communal land. And many of the concerns evident in the report of the crossing guards in the 1920s continue into the 1930s. So their anxieties about national ambiguity and Alsatian and Mosellan loyalty to France persisted. And the border remained a place where these questions of nationality were brought into relief. But in the 1930s, these fears adopted new forms. It happens almost from the turning of the decade, but it really gathers force after Hitler seized power in 1933. And the changed policies, I suppose, of the Third Reich triggered a shift in Franco-German relations. So for Alsace and the Moselle, there was geographical closeness to the Third Reich, but there were also social ties. And the presence of large numbers of refugees from Germany in the region meant that the population was acutely conscious of events in Germany. And I think, someone asked me once about whether you can talk about frontier mentalities, but I think certainly events in Germany are always read through the prism of the borderland position. So just after German troops marched into the demilitarised Rhineland, rumours began to spread through Alsace that border villages in Baden had started laying tubing across the roads, and this was to make the roads unusable in case of an invasion. So the population were very, very attuned to the possibility of war and really events in Germany through their own position. So as well as shifts in relations between France and Germany, there are also shifts in the situation in Europe. So reports from the checkpoint start to list new types of crossers, those fleeing the conflict in Spain or Polish migrant workers being repatriated as the French economy contracted. And this is what was going on as the crossing guards started to look at border crossings in a slightly different way. So between January and August 1933, the general controller for the region wrote to the premier in Paris to describe what he called a dramatic increase in illegal crossings from Germany into France. He said that this was unsurprising, given that Hitler's seizure of power had created a new political context. But what he thought was worthy of note was that the character of crossings had changed. So from Germany to France, there were now more spies, more political refugees and more smugglers. Meanwhile, the crossings from France to Germany were largely made up of secret agents heading home and individuals smuggling anti-Hitler propaganda, which he thought was also a risk in terms of border relations. And French administrators were kind of reading the drops in, so as well as increases in people crossing the border, there are also drops. And French administrators were interested in reading these through the international situation. So at Pentecost in June 1936, which was 3 months after German troops marched into the demilitarised Rhineland, the special commissioner at Kiel noted a marked drop in traffic in both directions at the bridge over the Rhine. So the number of French cars crossing to Germany declined from the 1935 total of 819, it went down to 312. And the number of foot passengers travelling from Germany to France dropped from 6,633 to 2,801. And there's a lot of correspondence about what to do about this, with international events affecting the practice of daily life and affecting tourism in the borderland. But in addition to monitoring crossings, administrators were also particularly interested in policing them. And whereas during the 1920s, administrators had been trying to make the crossings easier for borderland inhabitants, After 1933, attention turned to stopping them as far as possible. And this was something that worked in both directions. It wasn't just stopping Germans from entering France. It was also a concern about French citizens entering Germany. And this happened almost immediately. So from May 1933, there was a block on any groups wishing to cross the border. And very, very stringent checks were applied to any groups who did want to cross, whether they were a football team or a theatre troupe. And then on the other side, the prefect of the Lower Rhine took a particular interest in French citizens crossing into Germany, particularly after the remilitarisation of the Rhineland in March 1936. That year, he tried to ban French Alsatians, it's Alsatians is the word that he used. He tried to ban them from crossing the border. He said that too many of them went to the Black Forest to spend their Easter holiday and that they shouldn't be doing this while German troops are there, that this could provoke a scandal, especially if it's fonctionnaires, so state employees who are doing this, and they have to be stopped. They have to stop the potential scandal of French citizens, Alsatians rather, crossing the border. He said, of course, this would be a good thing because it would boost tourism in the Vosges, because if they can't go to Germany, they'll have to stay in France. So this, but I think this is interesting because of the change from the 1920s, when border crossings are encouraged, and this is viewed as a return to normality and a return to normal peaceful relations, whereas by the 1930s, this border crossings is a problem and a potentially pernicious act. And then to kind of another theme that you see continuing. So I talked about the border being the weak point and the strong point and a potential target. From November 1936, in this one example, a young man of apparent German nationality arrived at Kiel Station and asked how to acquire a passport from the French authorities. The crossing guard reported his presence to the police inspector, and when he spoke to the police inspector, he said that he had information to offer France about the construction of fortifications in Germany, that he could provide the photographs, but he needed a French passport to be able to do so. The police inspector sent him on his way, but his report of the incident reads this as the Germans trying to create a border incident, using the fact that the French would give someone an illegal German an illegal French passport as the reason to cross the border to create problems between France and Germany. And apparently this was a situation that occurred at other border checkpoints from March 1936 and from the remilitarisation of the Rhineland. So he urged all border stations to be on guard against such tricks. But we're kind of back again with the border as on the one hand of the strong point and the defensive limit, but also somewhere where crossing guards are particularly attuned to the potential threat, that this is a weak point of the nation. So I think I only wanted to talk for 45 minutes, so I'll draw my comments on the 1930s to a close there. But what struck me as I was reading it was that crossings continued in spite of change at the international level of Franco-German relations. That the monitoring of crossings reveals the continued tensions between France and its recovered departments, but that during this decade the focus of the crossing guards shifted from the locality to the different types of crossings, or to reading the motives of crossers against the international situation rather than the local situation. So, and the difference between their attempts to encourage crossings in the 1920s and to stop them in the 1930s is particularly striking. Although, of course, it's impossible to separate the locality from the national and the international situation. So that's something that we could perhaps talk about, how you think about how these different scales of analysis interact and what you get from these different frameworks in terms of scope. So, having tried to, I really enjoyed the evidence that I was reading for this. So I wanted to try and give you a sense of the kind of sources that come from crossing guards and what goes on. But to bring this together into conclusions. So the first thought that I had was about change over time. So I was very struck by the difference between the 19th century idea that it's possible for communes to own land on a neighbouring national territory, and that this is completely out of the question by the period after 1918, that there's emphasis on a neat border, that while there's continuity in the fact that good borders make good nations, the idea of what is a good border itself has shifted by the period after 1918. And so this has implications, these neighbouring relations. But then also the fact that there's change over time, even in the shorter period between the 1920s and between the 1930s. There is a shift in motivation for crossing, but much more strikingly, there is a shift in how crossings are interpreted. And I think that in this case, think about the connections between borders and nations. So where the crossing guards are focusing their attention and how they're interpreting their crossings is suggestive of where they identify the key threats to be. And I think that this speaks to the key threats that they've identified for the French Republic. So in the 1920s, it was national cohesion, the problems of reintegrating the recovered departments. But by the 1930s, their focus had shifted to Germany, to the menace of Nazism and the Third Reich. In both cases, there's an interaction between the local, the national, and the international. But how this is articulated and how it's described shifts. So the focus in the 1920s is described in local terms, whereas by the 1930s it's described in international political terms. And I think in this sense the focus on the border perhaps helps us to understand the continued importance of localities at moments of international crisis and these moments of massive cross-border passage. So the second point I wanted to make was about the construction of the border. I was quite struck reading the reports about how the border was drawn up by the fact that it was a collective enterprise. Both sides were involved. France and Germany were both represented on the delimitation committees. The views of both sides were listened to, but also the level of local and grassroots involvement, that local populations were able to petition the committees and that their views were listened to as well. So the border was a collective construction, but it wasn't formed in that period between 1919 and 1924 alone. It was also something that was ongoing. The border was made meaningful, was turned into a meaningful division by crossings and by contact from 1919 and up until the end of the period that I've been talking about. And contact took a number of different forms, and I've tried to give you a sense of the different types of crossing that centred on the border and the implications of these crossings. But one of the things that I think the crossings did was to breed an understanding of difference between the two sides. So this contact across the border created a clear sense of what was different between the German borderlanders coming from Baden to the Alsatian and Mosellan borders living on the French side of the border. And as a result of that, cross-border contact created a clearer sense of belonging to one particular national community, and crossings helped to make the border between France and Germany a meaningful division. And then the final thought that I had is one that I'm not really sure about this. I know I should have worked up to giving you a good conclusion rather than a question, but I think I'm just not really sure what to do with this. So it's about the point about the paradox of the border, Daphne Bedell's paradox of the border, but it's a point of intense clarity and complex ambiguity. You see that. You see that in the interactions of people at the border. You see that in the way that the border is described. And it certainly makes sense that the individuals who administrators might be surprised that they're speaking German, that they're eating choucroute, they're drinking beer, they don't seem to be the French citizens that they're expecting, but when they produce French identity papers, that crystallises things and changes the situation. That makes sense. But I suppose it's what we do with this, what we do with the paradox of the border and what that means for our understanding of borders and nations. I mean, the ambiguity, it doesn't just shape the policing of border crossings, it's also a product of it. So thinking about what drives it, I think, is interesting. I think And just as there are difficulties in deciding where the boundary line should go, there were probably greater difficulties in deciding who belonged within the national community and how we actually think about that and how we police them. And I think the monitoring and policing of crossings at the Franco-German border shows us the impact of these tensions that I've mentioned at the border between clarity and ambiguity upon the national community. So it's a kind of commonplace in histories of borders that on the one hand there are limits and the edge of a nation, and on the other there are a meeting point between the two. But thinking about crossings, it shows us what this actually means in practice for the people who are crossing, for national policy, for the borderland inhabitants. So I'd be interested to hear your thoughts about this. I think that people made the border, that's the second thing I said, but also the border helped to shape identities and to shape experiences. And thinking about the role of the border as a motive force in shaping the return of Alsace to France, it tells us things about nationhood and security and cohesion in the late Third Republic. And that's where I'll end.
Thank you very much, Charles. I think that was a fascinating paper. And I certainly have a couple of questions that I want to ask. But I think, first of all, it's only polite if I put it out to the floor to see if anyone has any questions that they would like to pose before I jump in. Yeah, Charles?
Thank you, Andy, for your paper. You talked a lot about, that was the core of your paper, the relation and the links between border and nation. I'm sure you will talk about this in the book, but I was wondering whether you could say a bit more about the relation between border and regions, and how, for example, you mentioned that German soldiers and German people living in Alsace left back to France around the 50% of the total population, went back to Germany. And I was wondering, what does that mean for regional identity and also departmental identity? Is that something that you look at, and can that kind of subcategory help to think further about this, the third one that you make about the paradox of the border? Like, is regional history and regionalism helpful to think about it rather than nation?
Yes, it certainly is. I did leave it out of this paper. I wasn't sure whether I should, or I wasn't sure whether it, to try and keep the focus just on the border as the border between two nation states. But of course, it's not. It's more than that. And the border, I think, the relationship between border and region is incredibly important in terms of how regional identity is articulated. And so, for example, the way that Alsatians talk about their relation, talk about French from the rest of France, is they talk about French from the interior. And this is a label that comes up after 1870, but it's still in use throughout the interwar years. So in 1870, it makes sense. After 1870, calling the rest of France French from the interior is signalling that Alsatians and Lorrainers see themselves as still part of France, but that they're, even though they're citizens of Germany, they remain part of France. But after 1918, when they are part of France, this really signals a sense of regional distinctiveness, but also one that's very, very closely connected to peripheral identity and identity as borderlanders. And the other way that it's articulated in terms of regionalism and regional culture and regional identity is in an idea that also comes up after 1870, which is that Alsace has a double culture, that it's a bridge across the Rhine, and so it has a culture that reflects its links to France and its links to Germany. And for a lot of people, this is political links to France, because it was at the Revolution that Alsace became part of France, and cultural links to Germany because of language, because of the fact that Gutenberg invented the printing press in Strasbourg, and all, apparently, and all of these kind of different links. And this double culture After 1870, it's used as a way of maintaining regional distinctiveness within the German Empire and allowing, or attempting to allow, connections to France to go on. After 1918, it almost serves the same function to excuse Alsatian distinctiveness within the Third Republic, to allow and to mediate the fact that there's strong commitment to speaking the German language, even from very committed Republicans, from the radicals and from the socialists, who are arguing that it's possible to speak German and to feel French. The notion of Alsace forming a bridge across the Rhine and having a double culture, where regional culture is absolutely embedded in the fact that it's a borderland, is completely crucial. I suppose it's very much, actually it's more about being a borderland, so the relationship between it as a borderland than about the relationship between the border and the region. So it's enormously important. And then the question about the departure of large numbers of Germans and the impact that that has on regional identity, it affects things in a range of different ways. So for one thing, losing 15% of the population in terms of border crossings, it means that most Alsatians have ties across the Rhine. They have a reason to cross the border, so it creates lots of extra border crossings. But it turns kind of the fabric of social life in on itself. So those who leave, on the one hand, there are elites, so it's priests, it's pastors, it's university professors, it's engineers, it's military personnel, German civil servants, which creates an enormous hole in terms of regional life and in terms of who's left. It is also towards the bottom of society, so the unemployed who are forced to leave, prostitutes, beggars, known troublemakers, socialists. I'm not kind of putting them into the same bag as those other ones who are forced to leave, but they're also disproportionately targeted. And it kind of raises questions about who is Alsatian and who is French, because a lot of those who are forced to leave because they're German had been born in Alsace or in Lorraine, but they were labelled as German because when the French came in and they classified the population on the basis of ethnicity, it was on the basis of 4 identity cards. And so if your parents were born in Alsace-Lorraine, you had an A card. But if you were born in Alsace-Lorraine to parents born in other states of the German Empire, you had a D card, which meant massively different rates of currency exchange. You weren't allowed to work in certain employments. You weren't allowed to cross the border. Some people weren't allowed to leave the town that they were registered in. And so who was German? It created a lot of questions, and because this was the context to the French coming in the beginning of French rule, it puts questions of nationality and nationhood and ethnicity at the forefront of all of the debates about what it means for the region to become French again. It reinforces the importance of ethnicity and nationality. And so the national ambivalence that the French are detecting, people within Alsace are questioning what it means to be French and coming up with their own answers. It's in this context, everything is very, very fluid.
Absolutely, please.
You didn't talk about German refugees. Is that another subject that you refer to?
Do you mean German refugees kind of throughout the period?
No, from 33 on.
Yes, so that's also something that has a massive impact on it. They were one of the groups, and I was really surprised not to find more about them in the reports of crossing guards. That was one of the things that surprised me. And the other thing that surprised me, which someone else might want to talk about, is that there was no mention of class. I really expected them to talk about class when they talk about border crossings, and it just wasn't there. But the German refugees was something that I really expected to find. And it was an absence, which might be because of the records. There tend to be a lot more records in Alsace and Lorraine in the 1920s than there are in the 1930s. But it might be that the attention of the crossing guards wasn't as focused on them as I would have expected. But they did have an enormous impact on life. in the region, particularly in Strasbourg, because they tended to settle in the large towns. So it's largely Strasbourg, to a certain extent in Colmar and Mulhouse. A lot of them had existing links because the first refugees were socialists and communists, and so they had links to the Alsatian Socialist and Communist Party because they'd been part of the same... They'd both been part of the SPD, or... Well, they'd all been part of the SPD, hadn't they, before 1918, so they had links. They spoke the same language, there were cultural connections. And they... The reports that I've read from police on their position within... within the cities is that they integrated reasonably rapidly and reasonably quickly, but the police blamed them for the circulation of rumours about what's going on in Germany. And for the police talk about a problem that the Alsatians are very, very attuned to the possibility of war, that there's all of these rumours going around about war breaking out, and the Alsatians refused to invest in treasury bonds or withdraw money or sell things, and don't want to invest in francs. And the German refugees from Germany after 1933 are blamed for that. But I think what they do is they create a very, very clear sense of what exactly is happening in the Third Reich. So it comes back to the point about contact breeding a sense of closeness, but also breeding a sense of difference. And so... the way that... Sorry, I'm not explaining this very well. After 1918, one of the things that I've been really struck by is the French coming in and seeing what they perceive to be German influence everywhere in Alsace, and Alsatians arguing that actually it's Alsatian rather than German. But the presence of refugees after 1933 changes the parameters of the debate, because then there's a need to distinguish between what's Nazi and what's German, as well as Alsatianness and Germanness. So there was one protest about the presence of refugees in the summer of 1933, and there was a lot of debate in Strasbourg. A lot of the debate in the Strasbourg City Council was about whether this makes the region look anti-German, or whether people will recognise that it's an anti-Hitler demonstration. So the presence of the refugees, it kind of creates a sense of awareness, a sense of closeness, a sense of threat, but it also shifts the debates about who is part of the national community by complicating the question of what is German by introducing Nazism into it.
Very interesting paper. First of all, do you know who drew that cartoon?
It's Hansi.
Who was, of course, Alsatian.
Yes.
Yes. And my question is partly about Alsatian identity. Because before 1871, Alsace was, the language that we used was French and Alsatian. And as I understand it from work that other people have done on that period, 1871 to 1918, the Germans, in fact, wanted German to be used, not Alsatian and not French. And I wondered what the French idea was in 1918, whether they wanted to Frenchify Alsace or whether they wanted to restore an Alsatian identity. So that's question number one. And question number two is just numbers, really. You said 150,000 Germans left Alsace in 1918 when French reacquired Alsace, and that's getting on for about 8% of the population, if you reckon the population is 1.8 million. 15%.
It's Alsace and the Moselle. Sorry.
How does that compare with the numbers who left Alsace when Alsace became German in 1871? And what proportion of the people who left were people whose families had migrated to Alsace after the Germans took it over? So the questions are really about identity.
And so in terms of the percentages, I can't remember what the percentage is exactly who left after 1871, but it's definitely lower than that left after 1918.
No.
It is lower, but there is an issue in terms of how it's counted, because after 1871 the Germans gave Alsatians and Lorrainers the opportunity to opt for French nationality, which, you know, could be a gesture to civic nationhood, but actually they had to leave all of their possessions, and so there's a question about how far this was a genuine choice. And a lot of, so some of the statistics are based on those who took that option, but not everyone who took the option actually left. And in some towns, this was particularly in the upper Rhine department, this was done as a gesture, as a protest against German nationality. So people took the option with no intention of leaving. Mm-hmm. Others left without actually taking the option. So the numbers after 1871 are slightly murkier. But I can't remember the number. I should have thought about this. But I'm sure as a proportion, as a percentage, it's lower. But there are similarities in that it's the same types of people who left. So it's the elites, the elite groups who left in 1871. So in both times, this created a hole in terms of regional society because of the departure of the elites. And I think that's a lot. It tended to be the priests stayed, and I think that's one of the reasons for the strong attachment to the Catholic Church and the Catholic Party in Alsace, was that the clergy represented a kind of source of stability with the departure of different types of elite groups in 1871 and 1918. Was there another question about the percentage of numbers who left?
The Alsatian identity, that, as I understand it, the Germans very positively wanted to turn Alsace into German, do the people who leave, are they in 1918? Are they predominantly people whose families had migrated to the region after 1871?
The majority are. The majority are either those who themselves migrated after 1871 because they were sent there, so military personnel, university professors, civil servants. Others who left a lot, it's because their families migrated and they were given D cards, which in this kind of identity classification meant that even though they were choosing to leave, actually you can question once again how far this is voluntary, because there was a very punitive rate of exchange from francs to marks, difficulties in finding employment. And so, because the conditions after the return of France were particularly bad for these groups, it did tend to be them. But then there was also a good percentage of Alsatians who chose to leave because they thought they would have a better life in the Weimar Republic, or because they were very committed to the idea of German Alsace-Lorraine. And there was the centre that was set up in Frankfurt for Germanophile Alsace-Lorrainers who have continued the struggle over frontiers through education and through historical research. And so I've read some accounts of Alsatians who left because they didn't believe that Alsace-Lorraine were French, and so they left for those reasons. So there's a very, very mixed picture, but the vast majority of those who were either born in Germany or born to parents who'd been born in Germany. In terms of the French wanting to Frenchify Alsace or Alsatianise it, they want to make it French. The thing with language is interesting because a lot of administrators came in and they saw that people were speaking German and they hadn't expected that. But they just assumed that this was the result of 50 years of German rule rather than the fact that in 1871 most Alsatians spoke Alsatian dialect. Mm-hmm. And because Alsatian dialect is a Germanic dialect, it was a lot more straightforward for the Germans to introduce High German as the language of the press and the language in courts. And I suppose the French didn't have a very clear idea of what Alsatianness was. And then this wasn't helped because there was no unified idea of what Alsatianness was in Alsace and Lorraine either. So it's all of the stuff about national identity and national integration, and people have moved away from those peasants into Frenchmen idea and talked about actually the peripheries and remote force in the creation of nations. But I think in Alsace that kind of implies some unity, but there isn't any unity in either Paris or in Alsace. There's so many different ideas. So it's more, it's not a two-way interaction between centre and periphery. It's just a massive bun fight going on at the centre and the periphery, where everyone's got these different ideas about what it means to be Alsatian. And so that's to Charlotte about the double culture and the bridge across the Rhine. That becomes quite persuasive, and people from a range of different political and cultural and religious positions in Alsace can accept that, because it gets away from the divisions that come up over other issues. So whether it's fundamentally Alsatian to have the Concordat in Alsace. So there's individuals who say that they're Alsatian regionalists who want the separation of church and state, and others who say you can't be Alsatian because it's fundamentally Alsatian to have religious education. So the double culture offers a way of kind of preventing some kind of unity. But Germany just complicates it all the way through in the 1920s and 30s. It makes how you separate what's Alsatian from what is German is a very, very tricky and sticky question throughout the interwar years. And when an autonomous movement comes up and arises, and it arises because of frustration with French policies in the region, it starts to go wrong and fall apart, because there's such a massive spectrum of views that it was representing, from wanting the retention of regional laws in Alsace right the way through to leaving France and joining Germany. And so a number of autonomists were then reinstated by the Third Reich after 1940, when Alsace returned to German rule, because they have these connections. So Germany is always the problem for what is Alsatian throughout the interwar years.
It's just linked to that last bit of comment, I suppose, about language. I think you showed us on the map, actually, that there was a border.
Yeah, there's a language.
Because, I mean, you know, Peter Judson's written about this, like, frontier of language. I was wondering if this is anything, this kind of idea of, like, possession and dispossession of language. I mean, I've never really thought about it in a border region, but, I mean, it does make sense. Like, is this something that you've run up with? You come across?
I did try to talk about Lorraine in this paper, but I haven't actually done very much work. And most, I think the real language frontier is in the Moselle in Annex Lorraine. So the dialect there, it changes the situation slightly. So you can see the red line up there. And so Peter Judson's work about guardians of the nation, isn't it, and the language frontier, and so the importance of language and the idea of a frontier as a way to expand into a community, and the connection of that with spirit and identity. Alsace is actually quite neat in terms of language, and that the area where people speak French, I haven't really read very much from there. And again, it's the same
thing. Fascinating, though.
Yeah.
Because this is quite explosive at the moment. So many people, I mean, not in terms of border regions, but just in terms of state formation, people are looking at language.
Mm.
And I think this could be really interesting. It would fit quite nicely into these border discussions. Bilingualism, perhaps, in the 1920s.
Yeah, I think language is such a massive issue. In terms of what is Alsatian, there is, I mean, it's not 100% agreement, but there is quite widespread agreement that bilingualism should be a fundamental part of being Alsatian. There isn't agreement over which language should come first, but the necessity of bilingualism is something that you see, that you can get a surprising amount of agreement on. The problem is that the French don't really agree, and so they introduced the direct method into schools, and so there's lots of talk about a generation of school children who are growing up unable to express themselves in French or German. Famous cases of people who can't defend themselves in court being tried by a jury that can't understand the court case because everything's in French and none of them do. So it's kind of the negotiation is between France and Alsace over the place of bilingualism. I think one of the things that is interesting, I think, is that they the French that language isn't quite as important as it was after 1870. That perhaps the local language is allowed to go on, but once again it's German that complicates things. I think if because of the connections with German, this makes things much more problematic than they might be otherwise. So again, to come back to this double culture, there were individuals in the 1930s who were making the argument for bilingualism, saying, you know, look, there's two Germanys, there's the Germany of Hitler, but there's also the Germany of Goethe and Schiller, and we can bring you both. But it's kind of a process of negotiation between centre and periphery that's with no clear set of views on either side.
I was going to dive in and ask a quick question, if that's all right. And actually, it's either an interesting question or an extraordinarily annoying question. And it was just about the identity of the border guards themselves. Whether or not they are civil servants or in the army, so whether they are from the region, or whether they themselves are people that have been raised, you know, elsewhere, you know, in the interior of France, on myths of the lost provinces, etc. So I wonder if they are themselves of the region, or whether they themselves carry that seed of the kind of ambiguous nationality.
They're unusual in that most of the local police, the lower levels, are natives of Alsace-Moselle, whereas the border guards are brought in from elsewhere. So they're quite unusual in terms of lower level administrators in that they come from the rest of France. So the prefects are always from somewhere else and the sub-prefects come from somewhere else, but then the kind of lower level administrators tend to have been born in the region, but the border guards are different, which I think tells us something as well about how they were viewed.
On the back of that, what kind of theatre was going on at the border? What kind of impression were they trying to give? I mean, in terms of how the guards were stationed, what kind of barriers there were, whether there was lots of barbed wire and flags, all that kind of thing, whether it changed as well over the period?
So the French were really concerned about this, and there's actually reports about this. These moments where you find a source, this is exactly what I wanted you to say. And so someone said, this is one of the only points where our two nations come up against each other, and we have to think very carefully about how we're facing Germany. And I thought that it would be like a kind of Soviet Union Third Reich at the exhibition, kind of really facing each other. But they're actually very keen to be subtle. So the Germans go for really ostentatious border posts. We can show how different we are by nice, subtle posts. So having quite kind of low-key things painted in the colours of the tricolour with just the F on it, and then that sends a massive statement about what it means to be French compared to what it means to be German. I don't know if it changes. I haven't read anything about it changing. I've read things about vandalism of border posts, and that's quite interesting, just reading the questions like, is it just kids, is it just like, people messing around, or is it actually making a serious political statement when they cross out the D in where it should be, so kind of making it so it was the old frontier as it was, and how you read that and what you do about it, and if it's just graffiti. But I've only read one side of that correspondence, so I don't know what the answers are. I've just read the police talking about the vandalism. I haven't read the responses. But I should get a picture of the border posts. I should have something to show that. Hansi, who's done this one, he's got another great one of the Germans queuing up at the border post, which is exactly how I imagine it in terms of its subtlety. It's very kind of very low-key, just with the colours of the tricolour on it, and there's a group of fat and thin, bespeckled Germans. It's the Germans, thin as nails, looking with melancholy at their lost country, but wanting to come over is the point of it.
I wonder, when you talk about the idea of the border post, the French presenting themselves, so that French subtlety is not something you see in that idea of Frenchification that we mentioned before, about languages, about throwing up statues to Marianne, etc. Michael Keating talks about these kind of national identities in what he calls territorial crises, and that's what boosts these real kind of autonomous movements, these regional particularist movements. But you have other people talking about things, places like Silesia, about the idea that it's almost the idea of self-determination, the idea of nationalism, almost forces a nationality on this kind of, you know. I mean, interesting, you talked about the idea of, again, dual culture, neither French nor German. Of course, it's a book you turned me on to, the York one, neither German nor Pole, when you're talking about Silesia. And I wonder if you think there is a sense that, in part, the articulation of that Alsacian identity comes from, in a way, this kind of border battle, or whether you think it is itself something which is distinct or differentiated.
There's a couple of Alsatian scholars wrote a piece about the invention of Alsace as something that didn't exist before 1871. There were just two departments, and no one talked about Alsace anymore. I don't think it's quite as extreme as that, but it is something that's very, very much forced into relief by annexation, by return, by the battle that's going on about it. And I think one of the things that is quite striking in terms of the difference between Silesia and Central Europe, where you have states commenting on what's going on, is that Czech nationalists and German nationalists and Polish nationalists talk about national indifference in these areas. And the national indifference that they identify is bilingualism, regionalism, cosmopolitanism, socialism, intermarriage, or Catholicism. And they're all things that you see in Alsace, but that's not how it's interpreted by the state. I've never come across anyone using the phrase national indifference, which apparently comes up a lot in Peter Judson's work or Jim Bjork's work. But national ambivalence is used about Alsace. And it's a kind of subtle but quite interesting difference. And I've been thinking about whether, you know, how you can apply these terms to Alsace. It doesn't make sense, because the region is everywhere. And how a sense of Alsatianness is articulated is very much in response to the broader battle that's going on for Alsace between French and German. It's formed in relation to France and Germany and to what these nations are. So Alsatianness, to even talk about it as a bridge between France and Germany and a double culture, it's constantly built in reference to the two nations. But then whether that's just a way of speaking to nationalists in their own terms, so it's nations that have the power, so you speak to them in terms that they understand, or whether this is something that's meaningful is a bigger question. I think it's a combination of the two, would be how I would interpret it. But as always, I'm open to other thoughts.
Any other questions?
Could I ask for just a bit more clarification on language? The French always used in official documents and in newspapers French and Alsatian priority centre. So on one side, French, and the other side. The Germans, as I understand it, between 1871 and 1918, simply used German. So that's asking whether I'm right. Did the French go back to using French and Alsatian, or did they only use Alsatian in official documents after 1918?
So the Germans used just German, apart from in communes where there was over 80% French speakers, and then they did use French. But the French, in official documents, they started just using French, but then there were problems because they were saying, why haven't you done this? And didn't get the message. You sent us all these letters in French, but no one knows what they mean. That's kind of why it didn't happen. So then it was French and German rather than French and Alsatian. It was
so the culture that loses between 1871 and 1939 is Alsatian.
Yes, and it's not just in the French official documents. So Alsatian political parties would have posters in both languages. But the German is always much lengthier and much more detailed than the French. When newspapers start introducing a French language section, it's always, apart from the ones that are written entirely in French, for the German language newspapers from the early 20s, when they introduce a French language section, it's probably a tenth of the newspaper at the very most. Most of it is in German. Occasionally adverts are in French, but most of the rest of the newspaper is German. So it's coming from the grassroots as well as the French authorities.
So it is the borderline culture, the Alsatian culture and language that is really getting lost.
Yes.
And only people like Hansi cared about that.
But then Alsatians didn't think that Hansi was Alsatian enough. They thought he was a kind of insane Francophile and that he needed to have more sympathy to, you know, because his...
Oh, very definitely.
Yeah, because he'd write in French on his caricatures
his
rather than...
really horrible.
Yeah, exactly. And so Hansi wasn't Alsatian enough for some Alsatians. And again, this is like how you try and make this...
So would you say that Alsatian culture was an invented culture, invented by Francophiles after 1871? Because that would make it would seem rather odd, given that the French had been so careful to use Alsatian in official documents. I wonder what your view on that is.
I think the idea that France had of Alsace after 1871, a lot of that was invented. All of those brasseries that opened in Paris where they cooked choucroute and goose fat and that kind of stuff, it was an invention of an Alsace that met what France needed from Alsace in terms of having the lost provinces as something to rally the nation around. But then Alsatian émigrés bought into that culture, so kind of like, I don't know, Australians who wear kilts and become more Scottish than anyone in Scotland, and the Alsatian émigrés in Paris bought into that culture, and then a number of them went back to Alsace after 1918, and then there's a negotiation between a Paris-centred idea of Alsatian culture and an Alsatian idea of Alsatian culture. And in any case, I suppose the Parisian idea, part of it was based on the countryside and the traditional Alsatian costumes, which was certainly, I think, an invention. I've read lots of diaries where people talk about the women frantically making costumes in 1918 because the French troops are coming and they're going to be expecting the women to wear costumes, but no one has them, so you have to sew them. So that it was kind of based on this kind of rural, eternal Alsace. But then also in what it was like, it's kind of like an urban invention with the brasseries and the elegance of urban culture. So I do think it was an invention, but like with all invented traditions, it wasn't invented from nowhere, though where it came from.
Okay, well, thank you very much to Arsene. I'll ask you once again to join me in the pause and say thank you very much, guys.